This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite. Great to have you listening today. For the last several months, WUWM has been investigating the high rate of incarceration among black men in Wisconsin and Milwaukee. We've heard from community leaders who say putting so many men behind bars is hurting our communities, whereas Milwaukee's police chief argues communities must be protected from those who commit crimes. Author Malcolm Gladwell is inclined to agree with the former argument that the impact on the neighborhoods outweighs the benefit in fighting crime. It's part of a broader argument about how we misunderstand power laid out in his new book, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. We'll hear more of Gladwell's thoughts on Milwaukee's high rate of incarcerating black men next week, but first he explains how what we traditionally think of as advantages may in fact work against us, and how obstacles can often be what inspire us to overcome. Gladwell explains his argument to Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce with an example, how we misunderstand the classic biblical tale of David and Goliath.
The original story is perfect illustration of many of the themes I wanted to explore in the book. You have a situation where everyone assumes that the giant is going to win because he's the biggest and the strongest and the most sort of storied, right? The most experienced, the guy in all the glittering armor. And the first thing that's interesting with that story, of course, is that once David changes the rules, he upsets the balance of power. And in fact, the sling that David has in his hand, if you go back and read accounts of ancient warfare, it's an incredibly devastating weapon. It has a stopping power equal to a handgun. A stone coming from a sling and also slingers were incredibly accurate, particularly experienced ones like David was. So first of all, he's got superior technology to Goliath. And then the other thing that's really fascinating is that there's been a lot of speculation among endocrinologists that Goliath had a condition called acromegaly, which is would account for his size. It's a tumor on your pituitary gland. But it also has a side effect, which is it causes severely diminished vision. And if you read the Bible story closely, Goliath has all kinds of strange behavior that can really only be explained by the fact that he probably couldn't see very well. So the point is that the minute you dig below the surface of that story, you realize that David isn't this impossible one-in-a-million underdog. And Goliath, even though he appears to be so strong, is actually in many ways acutely vulnerable. He's big, lumbering, slow-moving giant who's up against a guy with superior technology, and he can't even see him. You know, so that got me going in the book and made me realize, you know, that you can probably look below the surface of lots of cases where two people confront each other or we face a challenge, and you can, if you're careful, you can see a very different picture.
Why do you think we so often assign a certain trait to be advantageous when really it actually is working against us?
I don't know. It's a really interesting question. It's almost like we have a default mode where we assume because the giant's big and strong, he must be the overwhelming favorite. That it's almost like we privilege certain characteristics over others. So I have a chapter in the book about elite schools, colleges, pointing out that going to the best college you can get into has advantages, but it also has disadvantages. And I tell the story of a young woman who goes to Brown to study science and ends up dropping out. And her story is very typical that, of course, we have huge dropout rates in science and math in this country. And if you look at who drops out in science and math, it is almost always the kids in the bottom third of the class. And it's because they look at the students around them and they feel dumb. They feel like they can't do it. Now, what's interesting about that is that you don't drop out because you're not smart enough to do the work. You drop out because you measure yourself against your immediate peers and feel like you can't compete. So if she had gone to a less elite school than Brown, she probably would have gotten her degree in science. Less elite schools are less prestigious, but they can offer you more freedom, the ability to do things, to complete tasks, to get degrees that you might not be able to do at a more prestigious place. So there's a case where we have a kind of immediate reaction to colleges that says, the most elite college I can get into is the one that confers the biggest advantage on me. But that's not true. That's only true in some cases. And so that's another example of this kind of the real story of advantage being more complicated than we imagine.
On the flip side, can disadvantages actually be advantageous?
Yeah, so that's what I explore in this. I have a whole section of the book which is concerned with what I call desirable difficulties. And this is an idea that comes from psychology where people have said, you know, most of the time when I make a task harder, more difficult to do, I impede your ability to do that task. I make it harder for you to learn what you need to learn. But that's not true all the time. There are other occasions where when I make your homework tougher, you end up learning more. And this, they call those kinds of things desirable difficulties. So I wondered whether, I have a chapter that asks the question of whether dyslexia can be, in certain cases, a desirable difficulty. And that's because we know from studying entrepreneurs that an extraordinary number of much higher than expected percentage of successful entrepreneurs suffer from dyslexia. And if you talk to them, and I interviewed scores of them, they will tell you that they think they succeeded not in spite of their dyslexia, but because of it. In other words, that being robbed of the ability to read easily and well forced them to learn other things, other skills, that turned out to be way more useful to them in their chosen career than the conventional set of skills they would have had. The kids who make it through school with dyslexia, at least in the years before we were identifying it at an early age and giving people special programs, the kids who made it through were the ones who learned how to delegate, how to get other people to help them, to do their job, to communicate orally really well, to problem solve, to cope with failure. Those are all things that are incredibly important if you're going to be a successful entrepreneur. So for some, it's not for everyone, of course, it's for some. I think you can say that.
I was going to say, for every successful entrepreneur, though, you do have a child who suffers and perhaps ultimately leaves school because of their disability.
Absolutely. In fact, if you go to the prisons, if you go to any prison in this country and you test the prisoners, you'll also find a much higher percentage of people who have dyslexia. So it's this really fascinating thing where it's either it is a real handicap, or in some small number of cases, it appears to be advantageous. I think that's typical of a lot of what I'm describing, these kind of underdog traits. They are high risk. They are either you win or you really lose. There's not a middle ground here.
There's a concept you talk about in the book called the inverted U curve, and it kind of goes along with this idea that there are limits to advantages, just as there may in fact be some advantageous parts to disadvantages.
Yeah, so this idea, it's a very simple notion, which is that something that is good in modest amounts rapidly becomes problematic in large amounts. And I started just by interviewing a very, very wealthy man who was talking about what his money had done to his children and how he realized, after he'd made hundreds of millions of dollars and raised these kids, that their lives had not been improved by him having that much money. He had robbed them of the chance to learn about the value of hard work and of self-reliance and of all these kinds of things. And I apply that. I think that's a rule that can be applied in lots of cases. And I use the example of class size. So we know that if you have very large classes and you reduce them, kids are better off. We have lots of evidence about that. If you go from a class of 35 kids to a class of 25 kids, it is a better learning experience for everyone involved. But there's a limit to how far you can push that. And so I looked at the research and also talked to hundreds of teachers and asked them the question, is there such a thing as a class that's too small? I was stunned to learn how many teachers said, absolutely. If a class gets too small, it's not a good learning experience anymore. There aren't enough voices in the room. There's not enough diversity of opinion. You can't have real discussion. Most crucially, kids who are struggling have a really hard time in really small classes because one of the things a kid who is struggling needs is someone else in the class who they can identify with, who's learning at the same pace, who's having the same problems, who's asking the same questions. They want company at the bottom. Right? Otherwise, they feel isolated and marginalized. And if a class is too small, there's no one else who's having the same problems as they are. And they're all alone. And that's hugely problematic for kids who are struggling. And so that says, you know, you can take that principle too far. And I would argue that many private schools take that principle too far. Their classes are too small for effective learning. I would also argue that we have squandered a lot of money in this country, lowering class sizes past the point where it is educationally meaningful. That money would be much better spent on things like identifying high-quality teachers and paying them properly. I think we can be much wiser in how we use our educational resources by keeping that principle in mind.
So if we take all of this in total, what does this teach us about how we evaluate advantages, disadvantages, our strengths, our shortcomings?
I think it teaches us that we need to be a lot more thoughtful, and we also need to be suspicious of many of the kinds of advantages that come from material resources. I mean, a lot of my book is about how there is a limit to what you can buy, to the kind of success or advantage that you can buy. That a lot of what matters, really matters in producing positive outcomes in the world, are much more subtle psychological things, the kinds of things that are in your heart, not that you can purchase, that courage and spirit and faith and anger and all those kinds of things are much more important in who wins and who loses than who has most money or the most weapons or the shiniest armor. I mean, the book ends up with a discussion of religious faith because I think ultimately it's something like that is far more crucial in determining people's behavior than some of the other things that we dwell on.
Well, Malcolm Gladwell, thank you so much for talking to us about David and Goliath.
I'm delighted. Thanks so much.
Best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1996. He is also author of The Tipping Point, Blink, Outliers, and What the Dog Saw, along with his latest book, David and Goliath. He'll be appearing in Milwaukee at UWM's Zelazo Center tonight for a sold-out event sponsored by Boswell Book Company. A stolen Stradivarius violin is still missing after a robbery in Milwaukee. How common are crimes like that? We'll speak with an expert in the field when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.